Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or for upcoming programs, you can friend this program on Facebook. Today's program is about October 7th, 2001. That was the date the Afghanistan War started. This program includes Ray McGovern and Professor Jonathan Stevenson talk to Peter B. Collins. They talk about Afghanistan and General David Petraeus. Retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern offers his views, and Jonathan Stevenson asks, has the president lost control of his generals? McGovern served 27 years in Army intelligence and at the CIA. Professor Stevenson teaches strategic studies at the Naval War College and has a background as a journalist. He notes that the generals are becoming bolder in overstepping their roles and that presidents are becoming more passive to this kind of behavior. They talk about Iraq, Afghanistan, Egypt, Libya, Bahrain, and Syria.
In today's podcast, two views of the president's shuffle of the cabinet-level posts related to national security. In our second segment, we'll be joined by Jonathan Stevenson, a professor of strategic studies at the U.S. Naval War College. He has an essay in the new issue of Harper's Magazine called Owned by the Army, subtitled, Has the President Lost Control of His Generals? And right at the end of the podcast today, Will Durst weighs in with one of his commentaries. This one is about the birthers and the production of the long-form birth certificate this week. And to lead our program, Ray McGovern returns to the Peter B. Collins Show, a longtime contributor, and he served our nation for more than 27 years as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency and an Army intelligence officer. And he works with Tell the Word now, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, and he writes frequently about important issues. Ray, welcome back to the show today.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
Well, I always appreciate your insight because you've been there, you've been briefed in black ops, and you've briefed the president on a daily basis about national security issues. And I wanted to get your thoughts about the musical chairs. This didn't come as a surprise. It was leaked as a trial balloon a few weeks ago. And just this week, the president announced that Leon Panetta is leaving the CIA to run the Pentagon, and David Petraeus is leaving the job running the war in Afghanistan to run the Central Intelligence Agency. Not only that, old hands like Ryan Crocker, the former ambassador to Pakistan and under Bush ambassador to Baghdad, will be rejoining the government to be ambassador to Kabul. And these are the old boys just shuffled into new jobs, Ray. And I'm not very excited about this shuffle. I don't see any real positive change in policy. And I don't see any outside or new ideas coming into a very closed decision-making process.
Well, welcome to the club, Peter B. Reading the Washington Post this morning, and, you know, it would be amusing if it weren't so serious, given the situation we face here with the wars and so forth. But a prominent spokesman for the White House was saying, you know, with Petraeus, Panetta, the Panera Bread. Oh, no, I didn't say Panera Bread. Petraeus, Panetta, and Crocker, you know, and that Marine guy who was the only guy who could speak without notes yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we couldn't find a better team. Well, you know, think about that. My goodness. They couldn't find a better team? Gosh, you know? I mean, for Pete's sake, these guys are responsible for all manner of failure, as well as death and destruction, and they couldn't find a better team. Well, you're quite right. It's a very inbred, it's a very in-looking, and it's a very, very... what shall I say, an insensitive team, because none of them, and I'd throw in Hillary there, who was lurking in the background, Hillary and, of course, Gates, none of them have any direct experience with the kind of suffering that they caused. It came to me, Peter B., in a microcosmic way, almost as a metaphor when I stood before Hillary Clinton about 12 yards in front of her and was, I was brutalized. It was pretty violent. Those guys that came, jumped me, lifted me up, and dragged me out to the aisle. For what? For simply having stood with my back to her. And she, and people say, wasn't that amazing? You know, she didn't miss a word. Well, she didn't miss a syllable.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't miss having seen what happened to me. And so metaphor, yeah, I think it's a metaphor for the ability of what my Irish grandmother used to call the upper crust, to simply be oblivious or to be, in a studied way, oblivious to the pain, the destruction, the loss of life that their policies cause. They can remain in this little bubble, this bubble illustrated by those distinguished people up there at the podium, and just to live a normal life without any reflection on what kinds of disasters occur because of their policies. So that, you know, that really speaks volumes, and that's why when they said they couldn't find another team, I said, oh, gosh, I wish they could find another. There are a lot of us around, you know. I don't mean me. I mean people like, you know, General Zinni or Larry Wilkerson or any number of people who know which end is up and are honest enough to say it.
So, Ray, without bringing in any new blood, it seems like the president isn't interested in anybody with different ideas from the inner circle that he has grown comfortable with, a lot of insiders, starting with the holdover Secretary of Defense who caused this game of musical chairs, Bobby Gates, as you like to call him, because you knew him back when.
Well, it was a lot sickening to hear the accolades thrown at Bobby Gates. You know, his big... The thing that the fawning corporate media praise him for most slavishly is instituting the surge in Iraq, the surge with the help of General Petraeus. Now,
And Leon Panetta, who served on Bush's Iraq study group.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting thing because Panetta and Gates also served in that group until he was nominated to take Rumsfeld's place.
Right.
That group came up with very, very sensible suggestions. First and foremost, no more troops to Iraq. For Pete's sake, no more troops to Iraq. And in that sense, they were saying the exact same thing that General Casey, commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, and General Abizaid, head of CENTCOM, were saying. They came back in September and October of 2006 and said, look, Mr. Senators and Representatives, we appreciate your support, but there's one thing we don't need. Please don't send any more troops.
Mm-hmm.
If you send more troops, these Iraqis will never get it through their head that they got to get their act together, get a decent government up there, and start operating. Otherwise, if we send more troops, that's never going to happen. Well, what George Bush did at that point, very clearly, went to the American Enterprise Institute, where all manner of neocon advisors reside, and he said, okay, now I'm told that it's a feckless effort in Iraq. We're going to have to pull out sooner or later. What happens if I don't send any more troops? And the answer came back very simply, well, Mr. President, if you don't send any more troops, you're going to lose a war on your watch. And Bush said, well, that's not good. Well, draw me up a plan where I won't lose a war on my watch. And they drew up this plan, send 20, 22, 23,000 more troops. We'll have a surge, and we'll do what's necessary to prevent you and Dick Cheney from having to leave Washington under a cloud, having lost the war. Now, then there was a problem. Rumsfeld. What are we going to do about Rumsfeld? Well, they checked with Rumsfeld. You know what he told the president? Don't send any more troops. We got to get out of there. This is crazy. And this was right before the election in 2006. We have his memo.
Yep.
Okay? And so what does Bush do? Well, Bush says, well, we got to get somebody to take Rumsfeld's place. Now, my God, we'll get him. You know. So he checks with, you know, he checks with his daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And he checks with George Tenet, who was a friend of the Bushes. And, of course, George Tenet saved Bobby Gates' rear end when the Senate was not going to confirm Bobby Gates to be head of the CIA. George Tenet was the Senate Intelligence Committee staff director at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he owes a lot to this Bobby Gates, and now Gates would owe a lot to Tenet because Tenet and George H.W. Bush told the president, George W. Bush, hey, we got a guy, you know, he'd really like to be Secretary of Defense. He's been on the Iraq Study Group, so he knows a good bit about what's going on. He'll do what you want. All you have to do is make him Secretary of Defense. So what happens? 2 days before the election, Bush has Bobby Gates come to Crawford, and he says, hey, we got this new plan about Iraq. We're going to surge. And I know, Bobby, it seems like a fool's errand, but we got this guy with 10 rows of medals, 10, count them, on his left-hand breast. His name is Petraeus. We're going to make him out to be some sort of Petraeus ex machina, if you're okay. And we're going to say that, look.
Now, Ray, I just have to warn you, it's dangerous to rhyme things with Petraeus. Just ask moveon.org. But this is a good one.
Yeah, well, you know, it's for those listeners who weren't subjected to the torture of a classical education, they should know that in the old days, in the Greek tragedies, when the protagonist was in a helpless situation, you know, they were all closing in on him, and there was nowhere to go, no escape, well, then there was this machine.
Deus ex machina.
Yeah, and there would be a god attached to this machine, and the Derek would scoop down and literally pluck the hero out of danger, and so it became called a Deus ex machina, god from a machine, and that's how George W. Bush was sold by his father and George Tenet on the notion of, hey, this Petraeus, good-looking guy, hey, you know what? He went to Princeton. Yeah, he can read and write. And, you know, he's a comer. You have to realize that he's a real comer. As a matter of fact, you know, his classmates up there in West Point, they always described him as the kind of guy who would marry the commandant's daughter. As a matter of fact, that's what he actually did. Okay. Anyhow, here we are in Crawford, Texas, you know. And Bobby Gates says, well, tell me more about this Petraeus. And, of course, George Bush waxes eloquent about him. And Bobby Gates says, well, you know, it's a pretty daunting task. What am I going to have to do? Well, Petraeus will do the war. He'll do the surge. All you have to do is go out to Baghdad and tell Casey, General Casey, that he's got to retire. But not right away. We'll give him a sinecure. We'll make him Army Chief of Staff. But obviously, he's got to go because he's feeling his oats, and you know he's likely to squawk. And so we're going to make him retire. That's all you have to do. Go to Baghdad and get Casey out of there, and go to Tampa, Florida, where CENTCOM exists, and tell obviously that's it. You know. Mm-hmm. And the Gates says, and then I can. And the president, yeah, then you can be. Yeah, you can be Secretary of Defense. And Gates says, okay, I think I can do that. Now, what was the upshot of that? Americans just don't know that what happened in Baghdad beginning in 2007 was not, as it was described by George Bush, an attempt to make sure that there were, some respite was given to Baghdad leaders so that they could get their act together and get a government that worked. No, no. What it was ethnic cleansing, transforming the capital of Iraq, Baghdad, from a predominantly Sunni city into a predominantly Shia city behind the protection of U.S. forces.
And blast walls that were built, erected to separate the populations.
That's right. And what most people don't know is that, number one, that WikiLeaks photography from the Apache gunship over Baghdad in July of 2007, that was at the height of the surge. Number two, that was typical of the kind of indiscriminate killing that went on in those days. And number three, that's what Bradley Manning saw. He saw not only that, but he saw young Iraqi university students being wrapped up and put in jail for writing critical term papers about the Iraqi government. And the rub there, of course, is that Bradley Manning knew exactly what was happening in Iraqi jails, and he faced up to the moral dilemma of being part of that. And to his great credit, the age of 22 years old, said, that's not for me. I need to tell the American people what's really going on here. And now, of course, he's in great jeopardy, sitting in a jail in Kansas. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, all these things happened. It wasn't only the ethnic cleansing in Baghdad. It was also paying off the Sunni out there in Anbar province.
Right. So
that they would shoot at Al-Qaeda rather shoot mm-hmm. at us. And then, a masterful stroke, they persuaded Muqtada del-Sadr, the fiery Shiite cleric, to pursue his graduate studies in theology in Iran for a couple of years and just, you know, get out of town and tamp the thing down in among the Shia in Baghdad. So it worked. It worked like a charm, except what's the situation now? It's no better than it was before the surge. And what's the toll? The toll is 1,200 U.S. troops that are dead now, that wouldn't be dead if there were no surge, and countless tens of thousands of people in Baghdad and environs who are also dead or badly wounded or certainly driven from their homes. So, you know, the celebrated surge, I mean, you can celebrate it if you want, but that's what it was all about, and that's what the American people need to know and don't.
Now, General Petraeus has been somewhat like MacArthur in terms of feeling his own ego and his own, I guess, political independence, and has been willing to challenge at least the president's narrative regarding this so-called surge of troops in Afghanistan and the president's plan to start bringing those troops, some of them, home this summer, starting in July. And Petraeus, in public testimony before Congress, in comments in the media, has basically just said, that's not going to happen. And so given that his predecessor, McChrystal, was cashiered for intemperate remarks to Rolling Stone magazine, how is it that General Petraeus not only got away with that, but is getting promoted and coming back into Washington, where he's going to be in almost daily contact with the President of the United States?
Well, you know, Peter B., one has to take two steps back here and just realize how you get to be a four-star in the United States Army these days, and who bubbles to the top. We're talking not only about Petraeus, we're talking about McChrystal and others. In my view, and I'll say this as a former Army officer, the conscience, the devotion to honor duty is lacking at the top ranks. Ambition is what rules the roost. Now, my own interpretation about McChrystal's firing. Well, McChrystal, in my view, realized that after 6-8 months of the strategy that he was implementing, remember they were going to take that one town there in the south, and they were going to bring in a ready-made government and make that a model for taking Kandahar and the rest of them?
Sure.
Was a miserable failure. Mm-hmm. They still don't control that part of the country at night, and they expended the lives of a couple thousand Iraqis and some of our guys. Okay, so here's McChrystal realizing that his vaunted policies are not going to work. And so, in my view, he was very loose with his mouth, knowing full well that the Rolling Stone guy was going to publish this. He wanted to get fired. He wanted to get out of there. You know, he was, what was the title of that article? I remember it was
I don't recall.
The missing general, or the general that, well, the title seemed to be fitting in an ironic way because he was the general that wanted out of there. Generals can't quit, especially when they're losing and pretending to be winning. And so he asked to be fired. He was cashiered by Obama because Obama had no other choice. Now, how about Petraeus? Well, he knows that to say that the successes, the progress, have been, well, they've been fragile, and they're reversible. You know, you can only say that so many times before somebody's going to say, well, what do you mean, General? You know, how long are we going to have to stay there so that they become unfragile, you know, mm-hmm. and irreversible? And then he'll say, what he said before, well, it's going to take generations. Your kids and our grandkids are going to be fighting it. Well, that's not acceptable. So what does he do? He, I think, outfoxed Obama. He's coming home, okay? The withdrawal, such as it will be in July, will, if it's substantial, let's say 10,000, 20,000 troops, then those gains, or those fragile and not reversible gains, are going to be reversed and unfragilized, okay? And who's going to be to blame for that? This idiot Obama, who insisted on this policy, and Petraeus will be able to sit back and say, you know, I kind of told you guys, why didn't you listen to me, you know? Now, if there's only a marginal withdrawal, Petraeus will be only less, only slightly less well off, saying, well, you know, the president listened to me, and still there's going to be no, quote, prevailing, end quote, in that part of Afghanistan. So he's got it both ways. My bottom line is that Petraeus is very much interested in becoming president. I think he will be on the Republican ticket, if not this time, then in 5 years. I think that's the name of the game, and everything he is doing and likely to do in the interim, and especially he'll be able to do that being in Washington, will be to move the levers so that the Republicans will hire him on, and you know, who else they have, you know, who else they got, he'll be the candidate for sure, in my view.
So do you think that this is a political move on Obama's part to try to neutralize a potential challenger? And this invokes the old LBJ adage that I'd rather have him inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
Well, Peter B., I don't know if I would use your words, but yeah, I think so. Except the catch here is that Obama doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, you can't keep Petraeus inside the tent. Petraeus has got his own, as you've already pointed out, links to the military. And more important, Peter B., and this is something else people need to know, he's got very tight links to the pro-Israeli neocons.
Mm-hmm.
And this was revealed in a most unusual way by his inadvertent release of his own emails.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a story that would take 2 minutes to tell. I don't know if you want to spare the...
Let's do, and I want to refer to, I'll link to it in the show file at peterbcollins.com, but you wrote an excellent piece that's at consortiumnews.com where you recount this story about email exchanges with Max Boot.
Yeah. Now, Max Boot, of course, is the quintessential neocon. He was editor of the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. Now he's at the Council for Foreign Relations. Well, what happened was this. Somebody, probably one of Petraeus' staff, wrote something very sensible about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he said, you know, as long as this remains unresolved, we're just heaping up Islamic fanatics, Islamic dissidents, people who think that our identification with Israel and the billions of dollars of worth of arms and everything else we give them, that they think that this is unconscionable. And so they'll do everything they can to work against U.S. interests, to include terrorism. Well, they slipped something like that into his prepared remarks, in a sort of anodyne way. You know, they simply said that this makes it more difficult. The conflict increases anti-American sentiment. This is a quote, due to a perception of U.S. favoritism for Israel, end quote. Well, okay. I mean, then it says Al-Qaeda and other militant groups exploit that anger and mobilize support, end quote. Well, you know, that I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that, but that, you don't say that. You don't say that in Washington. The neocons consider that anathema. You can't say something that would reflect badly on Israel or, worse still, indicate that you really think they should show some flexibility on the Palestinian issue. So what did Petraeus do? Well, after he issued that written statement but avoided saying it in public before Congress, it got a bit of notice, you know, internet, even in some of the phoning corporate media. They know, what is this, you know? And so what does he do? He writes to Max Boot, and he says, look, please, remember, I didn't say that. It was in, you know, it was in my written submission, but I didn't say it. Am I in trouble? And Max Boot says, well, no, I've just written an op-ed which the title of which is, quote, a lie. A lie that David Petraeus is anti-Israel. And Petraeus wouldn't stop. He says, well, you know, what do I need to do? And this is a direct quote from the email. Quote, does it help, folks? Does it help if folks know that I hosted Elie Wiesel and his wife at our quarters on Sunday night? Would it help if they knew that I was a speaker for the 65th anniversary of the liberation from the concentration camps? What do I need to do? And finally, Boot answers, look, relax. No, I don't think you have to do that because you're no longer being accused of being anti-Semitic. And that's when Petraeus responds, Roger! Exclamation point. And then he types in, you know,
a smiley
a
face.
And a dash and a, you know, a smile face.
Yeah.
So, you know, this kind of pandering, you know, we're going to have this from the director of the Central Intelligence Agency now. This is real, real trouble. And the guy is just really so ambitious that he will cater to the Zionist lobby in a way that that fellow Chaz Freeman, who was turned down for the head of analysis in the intelligence community, would never have done. And so the president is depriving himself, probably quite knowingly, of any balance in addressing this issue as well, and that's trouble ahead.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
And now for something completely different.